Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is astrophysicist Dr. Christine Corbett Moran. Christine, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on the show. I've been following your exploits, following you on Twitter, your South Pole adventures. We're going to talk about that later in the show. Very cool. So you are an astrophysicist who specializes in computational astrophysics, high-performance computing, big data visualization, and you're primarily interested in the gravitational force, which you described as the most beautiful and mysterious of all of nature's fundamental forces. I agree. I studied general relativity in graduate school, and I'm right there with you. So all of us astrophysicists had a triggering event. Something happened in our early days. For me, it was looking through a telescope and seeing Saturn live for the first time. How about you? How did you get started?
I kind of gradually fell into it, actually, kind of like a frog in boiling water, they say. At a certain point, the pot's too hot to get out. I've always been interested in fundamental questions, why we're here, where we're going, our place in the universe. And I studied philosophy and mathematics and computer science and physics, trying to look into these questions. And the more work I did and the more progression I had in my courses, the more that I saw that physics, and in particular astrophysics and cosmology, was really doing the most to try to address these questions, not just debate them philosophically, but actually try to get at the root of the issue. And I love the connection between the practical work that I do on a daily level, which is intellectual, but also low level, and kind of the big questions. So I can always hook into when I'm programming any given day, has something to do with answering these big questions.
I studied philosophy as an undergraduate myself, as an astrophysicist, and I found that it was very important to discuss these big issues, consciousness, the universe, evolution, Descartes, Poincaré, all of the different philosophers who, natural philosophers in the Middle Ages who, you know, were scientists and philosophers together.
Yeah,
we do that. We tend to do that. Were there any special people who inspired you? For me, it was Carl Sagan and Brian Greene. How about you?
I definitely read some of Stephen Hawking's popular science books. Found those very inspirational. I read some popular science books on string theory and all of these things that you know, you realize you can actually study in depth and not just hear someone try to explain what it means to them to you. So certainly a variety of popular science books were inspirational. When I was already studying physics, I did read some Carl Sagan and read Cosmos. Mm-hmm. And that definitely was also just his kind of intense energy and passion and belief that this really is something highly meaningful for us to look into was also very inspirational.
One of my inspirations was Richard Feynman as well.
Yep.
He was his red book on physics, the three-book red books, got me through graduate school physics. I couldn't have survived without those books.
Yes, I had the chance to teach a quantum mechanics course, just assist it, but we used the third red book as our textbook primarily, and I had previously taken quantum mechanics courses, and I felt that even as the assistant, I was learning a lot from that red book. So his way of explaining things and kind of going down to the fundamentals and deriving the logic is very valuable.
Yeah, he used to say, if you can't explain it to undergraduates, you don't understand it yourself.
I believe that, too. So that was one of the reasons why I took the challenge of trying to be a teaching assistant for a quantum mechanics course.
Cool. I got to ask you, have you ever met Lisa Randall?
I have not, though she is certainly one of my heroes, and I track all of her work. I feel like in terms of if I were to make a list of physicists making deep theoretical contributions today, she would be number one or certainly in the top five. So she's definitely been an inspiration to me. I have not met her personally, though I've read some of her books as well.
Yeah, I just finished reading Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs.
I haven't read that one yet.
Very interesting.
But
As she makes the case that the sun is an oscillatory mode going above and below the galactic equator. And as it does that every 200 million years, it creates instability with the dark matter disk concentrated at the center of the galaxy. Mm. And when the sun passes through that dark matter disk, it destabilizes the Oort cloud. And then you have a comet come into the solar system, and poof, the dinosaurs go away.
Oh, goodness.
It's really cool. Well, maybe you can help me get her on the show someday, because that's one of my fantasies, to have her on the show as well.
I haven't met her yet either, but certainly
maybe
I can imagine her being a good fit. Not as much pull as dark matter, though.
So you started at MIT, wow, in physics and computer science.
That's right, yeah.
Was that a scholarship?
MIT doesn't offer merit-based scholarships. Mm-hmm. They do, along with a number of top-tier universities, offer need-based scholarships, which are based on your financial income. So basically, they assume that anyone who gets into MIT would be equally qualified for a merit-based scholarship. So they don't necessarily make a distinction there. But I was awarded. My mother is a widowed school teacher, so our family income isn't comparatively high to other MIT students. So I was awarded a very very nice need-based financial aid package, which allowed me to attend with almost no student loans throughout my time there.
I've talked to a lot of guests whose parents bought them an Apple or some other computer, and where their parents were teachers or doctors or scientists, and a combination of that influence set a lot of my guests off on their career. Was your mom a big influence on you too?
Not career-wise, definitely in terms of work ethic. My mom raised three kids as a single mother, went back to school, was working full-time. So she has an incredible work ethic and energy and was certainly an inspiration there. My late father did have some scientific interests. He was a lawyer but had studied physics and math in college. And he did buy a computer for our family, though it was one of the very early IBM models. So I had played around just a little bit with that, but it was basically defunct by the time I was 6 years old. So it wasn't that I had access to that. I have an aunt who had studied computer science some, and she encouraged our family to get a Mac. So we did have Macs around the house, and I had played with HyperCard a little bit and other things.
This is sounding very familiar.
And I remember kind of making different slides in HyperCard to make a plane go around in circles. And I enjoyed playing around with it, but really didn't have, I didn't have a concept of what computer programming was until I got to college. But I was already a lifelong Mac user. So definitely my college laptop, I sold my high school car and I bought a top of the line MacBook, which at the time was the thinnest computer that you had ever seen. It was the original kind of titanium MacBook.
And
it just blew people away when they saw it. So I bought the top of the end MacBook, and I remember being in line at the computer store and writing them out a check for, it must have been $2,000 or $3,000, and they insisted on, here was this 17-year-old 99-pound girl trying to write a check for thousands of dollars. They insisted on calling my bank to verify that I had the funds.
When Apple switched to FreeBSD, a Unix subsystem in Mac OS in 2001, were you really excited about that at that time, or were you too young to appreciate Unix and the Mac?
I was too young to appreciate it, though when I got to college and a lot of all MIT's internal computers in terms of their computer labs are all Linux-based, and all my coursework was heavily geared towards assuming that you had access to Linux machines or Linux boxes. So I was delighted to discover that I could do a lot of that fundamental computing just from this laptop that I had bought, and that ended up being a really good investment.
Absolutely. So you got your master's, but you went to the University of Zurich for that. That's fascinating. How did that come to be?
Well, I had done a lot of research in computer science and not that much in physics. And I had by this time decided I really wanted to go to graduate school in physics. So I thought I would get a master's in physics before applying to graduate school so that I would have a chance to do some more research and kind of hone down the field that I wanted to study in. And masters in physics are very common in Europe as more of the tail end of the undergraduate program. And I love traveling and love languages. And the University of Zurich in Switzerland has a huge group in computational astrophysics. And I decided that that would be kind of my best guess as to what I would like to pursue in terms of I love computing and programming, but also wanted to address these fundamental astrophysics questions. So computational astrophysics sounded great. And I was admitted to the program and went over there for a master's, loved that. So I decided to stay for my PhD there, instead of coming back to the U.S. for the PhD.
Cool. That must be related to CERN in some fashion, all the physicists in Switzerland. I'm just guessing.
There's a lot of physicists in Switzerland, absolutely. And there's a lot of astronomers and astrophysicists, as well as particle physicists at CERN. We certainly use some of the national supercomputing resources, and Switzerland invests a huge amount in science. Per capita, I think they have the most Nobel Prize winners of any country. So they're highly educated, highly prosperous society, and invests a lot of money into R&D and fundamental science. So it's a great place to do any sort of science. And because they're small as well, they have little niches. One of the little niches would be CERN. And they have a variety of other niches where they're really best in the world for that particular niche.
So then you went on to work on your PhD. But before you did that, I wanted to do a subroutine. You were at SpaceX. What did you do there? Sounds cool.
So that was actually shortly after I graduated with my PhD, but I did have the chance to be an intern at SpaceX, and I worked in the propulsion analysis department doing some of my big data visualization subroutine tasks, where I was working with large data sets that were from simulations of the Raptor engine, which is an engine under development that SpaceX hopes
that will take us to Mars. Is that the simulation of gas flow in the engine and the thermodynamics?
Combustion simulations, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we turn from subroutine. So you're into big data analysis and supercomputers. Tell me about the tools and the languages you use for that. Is it resident on your Mac, or do you just use your Mac as a terminal to a supercomputer for the visualization and the computations?
Sure. So it's a combination. So for visualization, I work with an open source program called ParaView, which you can have a client side, and then a lot of the visualization components and the data is residing on a cluster and running in parallel. And ParaView helps to automatically optimize where the visualization is done, whether it's doing the rendering remotely and then sending frames, or whether you're doing some rendering locally with some data transfer. And what you have to do as a programmer is write hooks into your data and analysis routines, and you can make menus and other cool things that work with your particular data set. But because ParaView is open source and all the programming can be done in C++ or optionally wrapped in Python as well, it's very customizable. So I work with that often for visualization.
Is this visualization of black holes in the Kip Thorne style?
It's not as beautiful as that. So you can do renderings and create movies and fly-throughs, but it requires a lot more programming. So oftentimes with movies, that would be more offline visualization. Mm. ParaView is great for interactive visualization, to load up, say, a terabyte of data and interact with it in real time, zoom in, make different cuts, kind of interact with your data. But a lot of times for the movies, for like Interstellar, if you're making a beautiful movie, you might want to do those renderings offline where it could take a minute to render a frame, where you would never want to have that interactivity. So because of ParaView's focus on interactivity, it's a little bit less suited for kind of movie quality images, more kind of down and dirty interacting with the data in real time.
I've read that you're working on how to understand black holes at the center of galaxies. We think that black holes, the astronomy community thinks that black holes are necessary for the formation of a galaxy. Are you working with the Event Horizon Telescope by any chance?
So I did work with the South Pole Telescope. And
yeah, but that's the radio telescope.
So. That's right. But actually, the Event Horizon Telescope is embedded at the South Pole as well.
Oh, okay.
So their hardware is all at the South Pole, and it's piggybacking on some of the South Pole Telescope's hardware. So they're currently under development. So they have a variety of different sites, but one of the sites was at the South Pole. I'm not part of the collaboration, so I'm not the expert at this.
Okay.
As far as I could tell, their South Pole site was not yet operational. So they had done a lot of prototyping, and it looks like they're going to start taking data, I think, this coming season at the South Pole. So I've not been directly involved with them. I've been more involved on the theoretical side versus the taking data. But it's certainly a super exciting project, and I'm going to track their results.
You recently returned from the South Pole. My wife has been there several times. But were you working with the submillimeter work for cosmic background radiation?
That's absolutely right. So the cosmic microwave background radiation, for those of our listeners who aren't theoretical physicists, is an echo from the Big Bang. It's light that has been traveling to us since about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. We can observe this light to try to infer what the universe was like at that very early point, as well as some of the things that have happened in the universe since then, such as the formation of massive galaxy clusters.
Right, and homogeneity of the background.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very important in terms of calibrating our cosmological theories, how much dark matter, how much dark energy there is, whether the universe will continue expanding forever or collapse at some point.
It has implications for inflation theory too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can, by observing certain parts of the spectrum, try to infer what happened even before that light was emitted in the epoch of inflation.
Right. So tell us why the South Pole is such a great place for submillimeter radiation.
So this sort of radiation is actually absorbed by water vapor, such as clouds, or if you have a lot of humidity. And the South Pole is a desert. And in addition, it's very high up. The atmosphere is quite thin. It's at about 10,000 feet. So you have this desert that's extremely remote, very dry. It has extremely stable weather because it's either light out or dark out. So there isn't this diurnal variation of the sun coming up and heating up and then going down. And so all these factors combined mean that it's a great place to try to observe this some millimeter wavelength radiation. It's as close as you can get to space with the advantages of being on Earth, where it's remote, but you can still kind of send parts and send scientists to regularly upgrade the hardware and keep up to date, more up to date than a space-based telescope, which would take more budget and more time to launch improved resolution components.
Very good, very good. Well, you know, we take a break in the middle of the show, and this is a really good time for that. When we come back from the ad, I want to ask you about life at the South Pole, what it was like, and some of the hobbies and things that you do. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds after this word. Stay with us. I'm speaking with Dr. Christine Corbett-Moran.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. So, Dr. Moran, how did you feel about being at the pole in a physical sense? It affects different people in different ways. my wife told me a lot of stories, but I wanted to ask you, did you feel like it was just a normal outpost like location, or did you have a sense for the coldness and the isolation? Tell me about your experiences.
Overall, I heard from a lot of people that a lot of people have trouble sleeping and trouble with the remoteness. I didn't necessarily have particular trouble with that. I did have this intense sense of austerity and beauty when I was walking alone on the continent at night with the auroras, and kind of a thought that I could potentially be the only person out on the continent at that particular moment, or certainly within 1,000 miles could be the only person out. And that's a really intense feeling. And it really feels like you're all alone in that element.
What was the temperature like when you were doing that walk?
It went down to -108 was the lowest. It was usually hovering.
But I bet you weren't out at 108. I bet you were out at -50, right?
I was out in both because the telescope was about a mile from the station, and it wasn't the case that I could choose exactly when the telescope might have problems and we need to be on site. And
so you had to do that walk no matter what.
Yeah, certainly we had to get daily eyes on the telescope, go out there, inspect it to do preventative maintenance and make sure to catch problems before they became an issue and affected data quality. So, of course, if it was especially windy, I might wait a few hours to see if the wind died down, but the temperature wouldn't necessarily vary over the course of a day. So oftentimes I couldn't choose what the temperature was and just had to go out there bundled up, of course. So it wasn't that I got frostbite that often.
Do you plan to go back to the pole? Do you want to?
I'd love to go back. I don't know if it will make sense for me to go for an entire winter again anytime soon. I got a lot out of the experience of wintering over, and I'm so glad I did. I'd love to go back for a summer, and possibly, though the astrophysics opportunities are fewer, I would love to visit Palmer Station or McMurdo Station, which are stations on the coast and have different scenery, different research opportunities, and have the ability to also see some of the Antarctic life, which
is just
gorgeous.
Well, you'll be disappointed in Palmer because it's really small compared to McMurdo.
That's right. Yeah, but a lot of the Antarctic scientists and personnel really speak very highly of Palmer. It's small, so it's not a huge town, but they really like the animal and the nature available there, the animal life and the nature.
Well, I'm going to shift gears here for a second because we're about 2/3 of the way through the show, and I wanted to ask you about some personal things and some of your hobbies and some of the things that you do. I noticed on your website that you've done some app development, which is very unusual for an astrophysicist. Tell me about that and how that came to be.
That's true. I had, since traveling as an undergrad around the world, I really saw smartphones in the hands of so many people who didn't necessarily have access to computers, and saw smartphones as kind of the future of where computing was going to interact with people versus desktop computing. So I always was interested in possibly learning more about developing software for this platform or these series of platforms. When I had that interest, it was back in the days of Nokia was the most advanced smartphone. So I did a little bit of programming for Nokia's, but it wasn't very fun. Certainly the phones weren't that smart yet. And just kind of put that on the back burner. When I was in my master's, I got the chance to, for a little extra money on the side, consult and learn how to do iOS app programming. As part of that, I worked on a Wikipedia client, a mobile Wikipedia client, where it was all of Wikipedia stored offline, so you'd have the ability to access it independent of your internet connection or whether your internet connection was censored, et cetera. And so that was really fun and got me straight into working on a production app and releasing that on the store. Very familiar with all that. Then I had the chance to, I subscribed to some mobile development lists, and there was a call for volunteers to work on a project relating to combating sexual assault and sexual violence in student communities. And I volunteered to do the prototype for that.
Is that the Circle of Six program?
That's the Circle of Six program. And so I did the prototype for that with a great team. We put a fantastic design on top of it. It was beautiful. And the prototype already had won an award sponsored by Vice President Biden and his staff. And so that kind of propelled this into actually not just having a prototype, but launching it on the store. And then, of course, we needed an Android app to go with it. So I taught myself Android app programming and went through that as well. I also did that from my Mac. And, of course, I have to have a Mac for iOS development. So all of that was extremely fun. Transitioned from that team. In that period, a friend of mine who I had been in touch with for years, Moxie Marlinspike, who's the co-founder of Open Whisper Systems, does secure mobile messaging, developed the Signal protocol, which is now used by many companies, including WhatsApp and Google and other places. At the time, they were a small company and didn't have a huge user base because they were Android only. They really need an iOS developer. And again, I got sucked into doing the prototype, doing an iOS app prototype of this. At the time, it was called Tech Secure, cryptographically secure messaging. And I did the prototype, kind of just showing some proof of concept features. And just was called back again and again. Moxie couldn't seem to find a full-time developer and just invited me to continue contributing code. And I recruited a friend of mine to help out as well. And we took that through launch of this now app that's available on both platforms called Signal, which now has millions of users. It's been very popular all over the world, especially in oppressive regimes where there's a possibility of censorship or a possibility of messages being spied on. And that same protocol has since been adopted by many large companies and is powering the cryptography to billions of people worldwide. So that was really meaningful and definitely got down and dirty with a production iOS coding there from a different perspective.
If you didn't love Max before, really... you loved it with Xcode, right?
Yeah, I really did enjoy. At first, Xcode does take a little bit of getting used to, but when you get used to the iOS app development tools, they're extremely powerful. And I always tell people that when I'm training, you know, someone to do Mac development, that you can do it all from the command line. You can do it all just native code, and that's always your instinct when you go into things. But there's a lot of tools that Xcode provides that allow you to extremely quickly prototype an app. And if you learn those tools, it's very beneficial to be able to do that for your creativity and also your productivity.
Excellent, excellent. I've also heard that flying is one of your hobbies. Do you have your private pilot's license by any chance?
I was working on my PPL, my private pilot's license, before I left for Antarctica. I had about 30 hours of flight training in on a Cessna 172 aircraft. Mm-hmm. And since going to Antarctica, I was away for a very long time from my flight training. So I haven't yet sat down and resumed. I had a lot of travel around the holidays. But very soon I'm going to go back up. And my husband as well has his private pilot's license. So it's one of our mutual hobbies where we enjoy making trips in a small aircraft and seeing the beautiful countryside here in Southern California.
I got to tell you, my wife and I took private pilot lessons when we were in the Air Force at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. And Eglin is an Air Force base with lots of big planes and jets moving very fast. And each one of us almost got killed by a jet fighter.
Oh, goodness.
Each one of us. I don't recommend it. I recommend it's a nice, small, quiet country airport where you can fly your Cessnas.
Yes. Yeah, we enjoy. There's an airport near Pasadena, California called El Monte, and that is our home airport. And it's very relaxed to fly out of, as long as you don't try to then fly out of over Los Angeles airport, because the Los Angeles airport and Los Angeles airspace can be, in fact, quite busy. So it does depend on where you're going. But if you kind of head out of LA, it certainly does get quiet real fast.
Another thing I'm very impressed with you is you were into martial arts, as I was years ago. I did Kenpo you're doing kung fu. How did you get into kung fu, and what did you have a choice? Because there's some interesting choices like Ishinru and Taekwondo and Kenpo.
Absolutely. So as an undergrad at MIT, you get the chance to take some physical sciences courses where that's actually phys ed and not physics. And you take four courses before you graduate. I'm kind of mixed my courses between martial arts and skating. So I very much enjoy roller skating, but I did some ice skating and ice hockey courses as well. And the martial arts courses I took were Aikido and I took Jiu-Jitsu, kind of sequentially. And I enjoyed both those martial arts. And so when I started my first job, kind of looked into things nearby, but Aikido was a little too quiet for me, and Jiu-Jitsu, the style that I studied, and I don't remember exactly which subset of Jiu-Jitsu it was, but at the time there was a lot of screaming, which we do sometimes in Kung Fu as well. In my Kung Fu class, there's like, yes, but it was for some reason, my perspective at the time was there was an inordinate amount of screaming. And I found a Kung Fu place that was very close to my work. And I loved their combination of styles. We would do yoga as a warm up, but then there was a good combination of fitness and kind of intellectual work with the forms.
I think you would like Kenpo too, if you ever have a chance. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of when I went for Kung Fu, and I've studied off and on over the years in different styles, and it's a bit hard when you're traveling a lot and moving.
Oh, yeah.
But I have a fantastic gym here in Pasadena that does Eagle Claw style Kung Fu, and it's just beautiful, and the teachers are fantastic. And so I go in there when I'm home and not traveling 2 to 3 times a week, and I'm just kind of progressing finally in my studies. Previously, I was switching gyms so often that I really never progressed to different belts, but I finally have a belt and am continuing to test out of additional levels as I go through my studies.
I think every young woman should take karate just for self-esteem and be able to, fend off unwanted approaches, and just for good measure, every young woman should take it as an undergraduate.
I think absolutely being comfortable with, that's one of the first things that you learn in any martial art, is just kind of being comfortable with taking up space and, being deliberate about your actions and not kind of being, passive. And that's a lot of fun. Something I also very much enjoy is I've done some of this study when I was living abroad. I lived in the Philippines for a bit, and I studied Muay Thai boxing or kickboxing. And I enjoy that because it's, first of all, it's really focused around fitness. So you get super fit when you study it, but it's also a very practical martial art. So practical that it's used in mixed martial arts. And that if you were to actually run across someone on the street, these kind of basic kicks and basic punches would be likely to be extremely useful. And it's a little bit less intellectual, but more sparring based. So I've also enjoyed training Muay Thai when I have the time.
A lot of young women are afraid to take karate or martial arts because they think they're going to get hurt, and some inscrutable hunk of an Asian fellow is going to beat up on them and yell at them and make them do things they can't do. And my experience, if you have the right school, and most of the schools are pretty good, is that it's camaraderie. There's respect, and there is strong admonitions against unwanted ruffianship, and you learn control and respect, and most instructors are pretty good about that. So all you young women out there, follow Dr. Moran's advice and get into that karate school.
I think it's great for young women and for young men to just kind of, because one of the things that young men and young women learn is also you don't have to fight. One of the first things you can do is just try to get out of a situation if someone grabs your wrist or something like that and run away. And that's kind of the first order of defense, not to engage.
Avoid
if you don't have to engage, that's avoid the fight. So I think that's key for people of any gender to kind of learn those maneuvers to just get you out of a situation, whether that's someone grabbing your wrist to grab you into a store,
sure,
to buy something because you're a Westerner traveling somewhere, because you're on the streets and there's someone very aggressive. So I think it's in general useful.
We learn all that absolutely. In this school. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So just have a few minutes. I want to finish up. I also read that you are applying to be a NASA astronaut. How is that going?
So I just went to the final round interviews. NASA is going to be having 50 people in for those final round interviews that they've selected out of 18,300 people. So it was such an honor to be included as part of that final 50. Just got back from those interviews, and NASA says they'll release the results in June or so. That's all public information available from their timeline. I'm not able to share any details about how the interviews went or talk about the process more than what's publicly available, but I've kind of done my part and made it to the final round, and so proud to have met a lot of people at NASA trying to advance humanity's space exploration capabilities.
You think you'll walk on Mars someday? Is that your goal?
I would absolutely love to walk on Mars one day. I don't know if that is something that I would be committed to me having to do that. I would love to be a part of the process. So if I have a part in making that happen, I feel like I'll have a very meaningful career.
Well, I have one final question with a sly grin. At this rate, Dr. Moran, when are you ever going to have time to become a chess grandmaster? You don't have to answer that. I'm just joking.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of hobbies that I don't have time for. I will say that I did buy a Go board to play at work. So sometimes myself and a colleague will play some Go games, but I have not at all progressed to the level anywhere near Grandmaster and any of these beautiful board game sports.
I was just kidding.
I know.
You're so good at so many things. Well, we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for this interesting tour of your career and inspiration and the discussion of astrophysics and martial arts. And this has just been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And it was great to geek out about physics and Max and
yes,
martial arts.
Absolutely. So tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
The best way to contact me is via my Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, which is my middle name. So @Corbett, and feel free to at me, get in touch. And I often do giveaways of books and other interesting souvenirs I find in the course of my travels. So I'd love to have more followers and interact with people in a meaningful way.
Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It's been wonderful. And listeners, I'm really glad you came by. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.